And if you look at places where they're having, where they're saying the Latin mass, young people are turning up in droves. The thing I cannot stand the most is patronizing behavior. And as an ethnic minority, people often patronize me for that reason. But we also do the same for young people. And we say, oh, young people can't access the King James Bible, or young people can't, because the language is too archaic, or young people don't want to see candles and smells and bells and all of this nonsense. It's like, how do you know that? Have you asked young people? And if so, have you asked them all? Because they're not all the same. They're a diverse bunch of people, just like the rest of us. And the data shows that tradition and scripture are what people want, and they are what works. This is why the church has survived for 2,000 years.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello, you're listening to Premier Christian Radio. You've joined me, Sam Hales, for The Profile, where we speak to a different Christian each and every week and find out something of their life, their faith, and their ministry. And I'm pleased to say my guest on the show this week is Calvin Robinson. Calvin is a writer, broadcaster, and conservative commentator. He's also minister in charge at Christ Church Harlesden in northwest London. Through his media work, Calvin has risen to prominence in recent months, attracting a large following on social media, 200,000 followers on Twitter at the last count, and often finds himself at the center of controversy, although he argues his opinions are based on common sense. He's broadcasting a new show on GB News, which is entitled Common Sense Crusade. Earlier this year, Calvin said he was blocked from ordination in the Church of England because of his political views. He's now part of the Free Church of England, which is a group rooted in Reformed Catholic beliefs. There's loads to discuss. Thank you, Calvin, so much for coming on the show.
My absolute pleasure, Sam. Thank you for that very thorough introduction.
So let's start with GB News, one of the newest news channels in Great Britain. And you're on a show called Common Sense Crusade. Why a name like that?
Because it's what we need in these times. We need some common sense. And the only way to really get that out is through a crusade. We're ready for a new crusade. We're in a spiritual war at the moment. People are getting sick and tired of being lied to and manipulated and abused, frankly, left, right, and center. And they're ready for some good old-fashioned common sense, I think, ready for a return to British values, to Christian values, and ready to being able to proclaim the truth without being persecuted for it.
Can you give me a couple of examples of where you feel like as a society we've lost our common sense?
Yeah, this is the problem. I'm going to say something that I think is totally ordinary and it's going to come across as controversial. But over the COVID pandemic, up until 2 years ago, no one would have ever dreamed of a Western country taking away the civil liberties of its inhabitants, of its citizens. And even now I can hear people screaming down the radio like, yes, but it was an emergency. It's like, okay, it was. Let's take that for granted. We all appreciate that it was a situation we'd never been in before. However, that doesn't change the fact until that moment, we would never have dreamed of telling an Englishman that his home is no longer his castle. And actually, he's not allowed to invite his own family into his house. He's only allowed to leave his house once a day for a certain amount of time, only allowed to do a certain amount of things, and only allowed to meet certain number of people. All of those things would have been bonkers up until the point of the pandemic. Now we take it for granted that the government has a right to tell us what to do, but we didn't until that moment. And I think that's a good area where common sense has been lost, because we would have, I thought, fought back against any kind of tyranny like that. And it is tyranny. It's not a hyperbolic word. It's quite literally taking away someone's liberties. And whether it's for a good reason or not is not the debate I'm in right now. So that's one area. And then, of course, there's the whole trans area of we all want to be compassionate, we all want to be loving and kind, and we all want to be inclusive to all types of people. However, taking all that into consideration, we're being told to deny things that we know to be true, and we're being told to deny biology, to deny science in general, but also to deny our faith in saying that it is possible for a person to be born in the wrong body, as if people aren't their body, and to be told that a man can become a woman and a man should be able to enter safe spaces that are designated explicitly for women. And we're being told that this is a normal thing and it's it's something that if you have any disagreement with or any even opinions on that aren't in line with that perspective, then you are the bigot, and you are no longer normal, and are no longer considered a good member of society. Now, I think all of this is heavily contested, heavily debatable, and therefore it needs a dose of common sense.
It's interesting, that idea of common sense kind of changing, because you're right. Before the COVID lockdown, which is the first example you used, I can remember when China went into full lockdown and there were people in the British media saying, well, that could never happen here because we don't have an authoritarian government that would lock people up. And then, of course, we all did get locked up. But to throw the common sense phrase back at you, you could say, well, common sense had to change. Before, common sense was you're free to leave your house and do what you like. But when there's a global pandemic, a deadly virus, we don't know exactly what this virus can do in the early stage, a common sense approach then would be to say, hey, while we don't know all the facts, let's err on the side of caution and keep people safe by staying inside. Is that not a common sense approach?
I mean, you could argue that, fair play. But I would say no, because at the point of the argument, it's majority rule. And if the majority of people believe that they have a right to live in common law, as we have always done for the last 2,000 years at least, then there should be some open debate about that before we change what we consider to be the common approach. Yeah. And I think the common approach is different to common sense anyway. But
well, it's fast. I love that within 5 minutes, we've already gone straight into debating the COVID lockdowns, which is fantastic. I need to try and drag this interview back to being about you and not just your opinions, which we will spend some more time on later on. But coming back to your life, I'd love to just go back to the early beginnings for you. You're well known as someone who is not just a conservative commentator, but you're well known as a Christian commentator. When you're on TV, you can see even from the way you dress that you're ordained. So tell me a bit about where faith first came into the picture for you. Did you grow up in a Christian family?
Nominally Christian, yeah. Church of England, typical Anglican family. Not particularly heavy in faith or anything, but I always had faith in my life. I always had a relationship with God. I always prayed and I always felt like my prayers were answered. But I struggled with the idea of organized religion. I still struggle with the idea of organized religion, which is probably why I got kicked out of one. The corruption, the hypocrisy, and the fallen nature of it by its very design, you know, being made up of fallen individuals, I struggle with that so much. And I always did, which is what I think kept me away from the faith for so long. You know, I was searching for a long, long time. I didn't know what I was searching for, but in the end I discovered it was Christ once I found him. But yeah, it was the institutions themselves that kept me away, which is ironic, really.
Yeah, that's interesting. Was that because of sort of personal experience? I mean, can you remember even as a child or a teenager seeing examples of church gone wrong or Christians doing bad things? Sadly, as you say, there are plenty of examples. Was something you were conscious of from quite a young age?
I think I was aware of it, but I don't think I would have been able to articulate it. You know, this is obviously before the time of woke, but I could already see that looking back, what I perceived to be wishy-washy kind of, you know, the cleric in jeans and t-shirt kind of trying to be hip and trendy with a guitar in hand, it all appeared a bit cheesy and a bit inauthentic to me. I could at least appreciate what the Roman Catholics had, which was an idea of beauty and splendor and something transcendental. Even that's gone now because of the VAT II post-70s effect has kicked in massively, and it's all been downgraded aesthetically on the most part. I'm generalizing, of course, but at least in the CV, I didn't see any of that. All I saw was the attempt at being trendy. I saw that as a fad. I saw that as nothing that's going to grab my attention. But also the links to obviously the child sex abuse scandals and all of that was something that I think is in many people's minds, and of course was in mine growing up too, that, you know, this is an institution that's made up of very, very flawed individuals that, yes, I need to stay away from. And of course, as you grow up, you realize that actually all institutions are made up of flawed individuals because we're all fallen. And in fact, when you look at the stats for things like child sex abuse, you see that actually it happens everywhere where people have access to children. Unfortunately, it's a great evil that we need to stamp out across the board, but it's nothing special in the church. And even, you know, even that's a revelation.
Yeah. So this was a wrestle for you on the one hand, believing in God, feeling like even from a young age, your prayers were answered. But on the other hand, looking at the institutional church, organized religion, and seeing the problems with it. Can you kind of pinpoint a moment in your adult life where faith became a bit more real for you? Or has it just always been there?
No, yeah, absolutely. I tried lots of different churches. I went with different friends who had different traditions, and it was always interesting, but nothing really clicked until I became a teacher for many reasons, which I later discovered was part of my calling, part of my vocation. But I became a teacher and I started going to the church linked to my school on a Sunday. I just felt called to go, really, and figure out what it's all about. And I experienced the Eucharist, and through that I experienced Christ, and I was touched by the Holy Spirit. And ever since that moment, I've been going, at least every week, most parts every day, to church. And it's been an important part of my life. But it's since that experience with a traditional Via Media Anglican Eucharist service that's really awakened me to what, you know, the Eucharist is when we're closest to Christ, after all. But I didn't know the theology behind it. I didn't know why the liturgy was important, but I felt something. Wow. Was important to me.
It might be an impossible question to answer, but can you describe what that experience felt like?
That's a good question.
Just for those who have perhaps no idea or reference point at all.
It touched my heart. I don't know how to describe it in mortal words, but I felt uplifted by it. I felt a presence. I felt something that I hadn't felt before. It's like the first time you fall in love. It's like you can't describe that feeling, but you know it when you experience it. It's intangible.
So you were a teacher. Was this primary or secondary school?
Secondary for the most part, but I did. I was a senior leader at an all through school. So.
And what came next career-wise after being a teacher?
That was it. That was my career. That was the start of my vocation, as I mentioned, and I kind of realized that it was only a part of it. Like, teaching is a major part of the priesthood, obviously.
So you went straight from teaching in a secondary school to then training for the priesthood, is that right?
I did. I went to seminary in Oxford for a couple of years, and I'm so thankful that I did. But yeah, it was teaching was the first part of that path.
So just for those who aren't aware of how these things kind of work, presumably you felt some sort of sense of a calling to train for the priesthood, and there was a process to go through. Can you just unpack a bit about what happens and what that means?
Yeah, of course. So while I was teaching, I was realizing that what we were doing was good. We were doing good works, but it wasn't always rooted in Christ. And I've always worked in Church of England schools, and Christ was very often missing from them, to be honest with you. And they always have Christian values, and they always have a Christian mission, so to speak, but it's often a second thought. And I figured if we're producing young people with great results, but not necessarily producing great people or good people, that is an issue right there. And I think that Christian schools, everywhere you walk, you should be able to say, where is Christ in this? And someone should have an answer. I don't think that's the case yet, but I do think it's something that we could work towards. And from that conversation, that is where I thought, you know, this is something that's important to me. The Eucharist itself is important to me as well. So I need to be in a place where I can not just work on the academic education, I can also work on the spiritual side of things. And I just felt like I needed to explore further options. And through that discernment process, in talking to my priest, my bishop, my archdeacon, and people like that, I eventually got recommended for training. And there are certain different routes you can take, different pathways available. I could have done part-time and just gone for a few evening classes in the week whilst still being a teacher, but I chose to go the residential route because I really wanted to be rooted in the experience. I wanted to be formed by it, not just trained. I wanted that prayer experience. You know, in seminary, we shape our life around prayer rather than the other way around. I think that is fundamental for the priesthood training. And it certainly helps me in my formation. I recommend it to anyone. So that's the pathway that I took. And it took a couple of years. And then at the end of it, you get recommended for a parish somewhere.
And while you were doing all this, was your kind of media platform growing? You were starting to do more writing and appearing on TV?
Yeah. I mean, I've always done that. So even as a teacher, I used to write about my experiences in training to teach and then in teaching, and I continued. And I think lockdown is when it really started to kick off, because I started getting invited onto the radio and TV more to talk about my experiences being locked down as a teacher. And then as I went into seminary, it became my hobby, because it's a very insular life in seminary. It's that, you know, you live in a religious community. It's very different to the outside world. So my kind of my output, if you like, or my interest was the media. So I kept writing and I kept appearing on TV and radio, and I kept being invited back on. So I was sharing my experience as an educator, but also my faith. And, you know, just this week, as we're recording, a poll has, or a piece of research has come out that shows that the vast majority of people want more religion in their news. I think it was 60 odd percent of people were saying that they're not getting it and they want more of it. And I think that's probably part of the reason I kept getting invited on, because it's something that people are wanting and not getting.
It must have been two very different worlds. On the one hand, as you say, residential studying for the priesthood, and on the other hand, writing for a national newspaper or going on TV. Was that ever slightly odd to get your head round? You know, on the one hand, kind of secluded, quiet, spiritual, and on the other hand, in front of millions of people?
No, not really. I've always thought of it as bivocational. You know, my media work, for me at least, the way I see it is that this platform that I've been given is a gift from God to be used for the greater glory of God. And it's my job to try, at least, to proclaim the truth and to spread the gospel. And I know people have different opinions on whether I do that or not, or how well I do that, but that's at least what I set out to do. And I feel like, you know, it's not an ambition. It's not a career goal. I don't want to become a full-time presenter, for example. I've been offered these roles and turned them down. I am definitely a minister first and foremost, but I use my platform to minister to a wider audience rather than anything else.
Is it always easy to keep that mindset? It must be a temptation to go in a direction that will bring more notoriety or interest, or it must be a temptation just to be like, well, this is a platform for me and my views. You know, is it hard to remain grounded and think, well, no, that I see this as a vocation and I am there to preach God's word and not just my own thoughts? Is that ever a tension?
I mean, of course, we're always tempted by these things, and vanity is one of the easiest sins to fall into. So we have to work hard on having ways of remaining humble and ways of staying grounded. And for me, my parish ministry is a great comfort, a great support in that, because I am in a deprived area of London with people, real people with real needs. And that is my day job, and that's where I am. And then I go on TV and I can talk about that experience firsthand rather than just commentating on what I perceive to be happening. I think that's important. But just having good people around you helps, and having, you know, lots of different people who can challenge you and hold you to account is important.
So you were studying within the Church of England for the priesthood. And unbeknown to you during this period, you since discovered that within the Church of England hierarchy, there were some comments and some rumblings and some emails about what you were doing. Just take us through the story of what happened when you're studying and really why your desire to be ordained in the Church of England, why it didn't happen.
Yeah, it's quite sad, really. I mean, I'm over it now because I'm where I'm supposed to be. And I think this was always how it was supposed to be. But it came to a point where at the end, right at the very end of my training, when I was supposed to be going to my parish as an assistant priest, as a curate, it was snatched away at the last minute. You know, I'd been promised a parish, I'd met the parishioners, I met the priest, we built up relationships, etc. But the paperwork never came through. And I got to a point where I was chasing it to find out what's going on. When the announcement was coming, and then the bishops made it known to me that they weren't going to ordain me in London, which is fair enough. It's their prerogative. They, you know, there is no bureaucracy to this degree in the church, as in they have full authority to make whatever decision they want. There's no policy, no procedure to follow, which make of that what you will. But it seemed poorly timed, as in they timed it to a point that I could no longer shop around, so to speak. I couldn't approach other dioceses to see if they'd want to ordain me because they'd already met their quotas. And it seemed unfair that time had been used as a weapon against me. And I asked if there's any reason that London didn't want to ordain me, and they said, yeah, because it would be too turbulent, and, you know, you'd have people complaining about your views and stuff like that. And I was like, okay, fair enough. Well, if people have been complaining, I understand, but let me see the complaints and I'll try and do better. Because I'm not here to be, I know you said earlier that I'm controversial. I'm not here to be controversial. I think it's a shame that my views are seen as controversial. And the bishops said, no, we can't show you that information. So I sent in a subject access request because I know under the law, they have to show me that information. If someone said something about me, they have to show me. And that's how we work here. So they did. They sent me all of the information they have on me, all of the emails, all of the text messages. And there was less than a handful of complaints about me. And they were all from, they were all from priests who were living with their gay partners. So in my eyes, in apostasy already, who clearly didn't like that I was saying we should be more orthodox, biblically rooted. So there's clearly conflict there. But anyway, those were negligible anyway, because they weren't important. Those complaints were spurious and there was nothing that came of them. But the big issue that I saw was that there were loads and loads of emails about me between the bishops. And the bishops had clearly been talking about me behind my back all of the time since before they recommended me for training. So I'd discerned a calling from God to enter ordained ministry, but that calling had to be confirmed by the church. And the church had confirmed that they felt that I was called to ordained ministry. And then the church had recommended me for training, spent £20,000 to £30,000 of parishioners' money on sending me to Oxford for the best training in the country. But all of that time, they decided amongst themselves that they didn't want to ordain me because of my views. And there were very clear, very explicit comments like, Calvin does not feel that this country is institutionally racist. We should keep an eye on his ordination process. Things like this, like he doesn't align with our politics. I don't believe the country is institutionally racist. No, I believe the country has many, many racists in it because these racists are individuals. They need to be held to personal account for their horrible ways. Racism is a sin and people should be, you know, should expect repercussions for that. However, that doesn't make the whole country racist. And someone who's, you know, I'm mixed race. I've been brought up in an entirely white area. I've experienced a lot of racism in my life. So for a middle class metropolitan liberal elite person to sit there, well, let's put it frankly, a white middle class bishop to sit there and tell me I'm wrong about the issues of racism is interesting, because they're saying they want to take on board more ethnic minority voices, but they didn't want to take on my on board my voice. And I'm asking the question, but why? If you are saying that we are racist and I have a different story to tell, why is my story not important in a time where all anecdotes, sorry, lived experiences are to be held in high regard? So it was all a bit baffling, but it essentially came down to it, the point that they didn't want me in London and they left it too late for me to go anywhere else. And it seems that there wasn't really a place for conservatives in the Church of England. And I know there will be people that say, of course there are conservatives, but look at it really and truly. Of the 116 bishops in the CAB, name one that's conservative, either theologically or politically. Like, honestly and truly, tell me one that's orthodox. And people will have a hard time because they are liberal gatekeepers at this point. And it's just because the way the CAV is structured in that recommendations no longer go through or by the Crown or by the Prime Minister. They go through a liberal civil servant, essentially, who has basically filled the church with people like themselves. And it's a great shame because they don't represent the people in the pews anymore.
When you went public with this story that you've just told, I noticed there were people who tick some of those liberal boxes who don't share your theological views, but who reached out to you and were defending you, saying, look, Calvin, I don't agree with your politics. I don't even agree with some of your theology, but the whole point of the Church of England is we're supposed to be a broad church. And a lot of people were very upset that you weren't allowed in because it did feel like there was this double standard. What was your reaction when you saw that happening? And have you been able to have any kind of communication with some of the people involved in these decisions to seek to reconcile or to find a path forward, even if you can't agree on some of the details of what happened?
The level of support was absolutely amazing. It's so heartwarming. People that would be my natural opponents politically or even theologically were very, very supportive for the most part. Everyone, you know, the left and the right of both spectrums, it was great to see. And I think it really highlighted the problem, the issue at hand, in that the church has become, what's the opposite of neurodiverse? Become an echo chamber of groupthink mentality, and that's a problem. And I think most people admit that that's a problem, especially if you look at the wider church. We saw this with the Lambeth Conference, didn't we? We saw that, you know, 75% of the Anglican Communion are still quite orthodox, and it's just England, North America, and Australia that have gone hyper-liberal, and as a result, they're splitting. And it's been
pointed out before, hasn't it, that if you look at those in the pews in the Church of England, it's it's fairly balanced, isn't it? I mean, if you take an issue like Brexit, you know, most people in the Church of England, like the country, probably marginally just most people voted to leave. But as you say, if you look at the bishops...
Well, in the pews, more people voted for Brexit than in the country in general. So we have quite a Brexiteer congregation.
Right. But if you look at the bishops, I think, was it just one bishop who said they voted to leave and all the others have been remainers? So there is a disconnect, isn't there, politically, between what people who go to a church think and what their leaders think.
Yeah, absolutely, Simon. And I would ask listeners to find out what happened to that one bishop who spoke out saying he voted to leave, because he's no longer a bishop. This is the problem that we see.
When it comes to the reasons for you not going forward for being ordained, some people will say, well, does the church want anyone, whether left or right, to be on TV giving their views on politics at all? There are some Christians who say, actually, as Christians, we need to stay away from politics. It's a messy, dirty game. And whether you're left or right, you know, if you're in a dog collar on TV being very left wing or being very right wing, that doesn't represent Christianity. What's your response to that kind of a criticism of why someone in your position who is prominent in the media for commentating on political issues, for why people might have a bit of a problem with that and saying, yeah, but Calvin, you're there to represent God, not to represent the right wing or the right of center?
I would say there are very, very few Christians on television these days, and we used to have a lot more. Now, if there's an opportunity for a Christian to speak on TV, I think that's a good thing in any media, actually. And it's not about being right wing or being conservative or anything like that. You know, I criticize the conservative government as much as I criticize the Labour Party. It's not that I'm out promoting the conservative party. It's just that my views happen to be conservative. And I think that that's because I get them from scripture. At least I try to. I try to root my political views around from my faith rather than the other way around. And I think most people should try to do that. We just come to different perspectives on it. So I think we should absolutely use the media and we should use it to our advantage. You know, I've invited the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Archbishop of York, and the Bishop of London, the three most powerful and influential people in the Church of England, to have my platform, not to be on it with me, to have my platform. And they've refused. They don't want to go on GB News, which is a great shame because there's a massive audience there of people willing and eager and ready to listen to the good news. And they should, you know, if people are sitting back saying, I'm not the right person to be giving it to them, then they should be taking that opportunity to give it to them. And they're not.
How comfortable are you with those categories, you know, being described as right wing or conservative? Because GB News will be viewed by many as, well, it's a right of centre, certainly, broadcaster. And the same people will probably say that Channel 4, for example, is left of centre. Like, how comfortable are you with those terms and those categories?
I would refute both of those. I don't think GB News is right of centre. I think GB News tries its very best to have a balance. There's always someone from the right, someone from the left on every single conversation, which is something we don't see on, for example, the BBC, where they'll outnumber Brexiteers with Remainers on purpose to address the balance. And Channel 4, I wouldn't say, is left-wing. In fact, Channel 4 and the BBC are very similar in that it's a metropolitan liberal elite bias. It's a Westminster London bubble bias. It's people that don't actually go into the heart of the country and meet normal folk anymore. That's the bias that they have. It appears left-wing at times, but it isn't always. But in regards to me, I don't really care what label people use. I think it's lazy. People often say right wing. Some people say far right, which is absolutely crazy. It's just that the Overton window has shifted so far to the left that anyone right of Marx is a far right person these days. But if it helps people, it gives them comfort in their own issues, then fair enough. They can label me whatever they like. But I'm a Christian. I'm English. I'm British. They're the only identities that I care about.
So, as you say, you were at one point hoping to be ordained in the Church of England. It's remarkable, really, how far you got in one sense. I mean, given how critical you have been, even in this conversation of the Church of England, you were for a long time still wanting to be ordained within that church. Now, you subsequently moved on. So tell us a little bit about what happened next and where you sit now and why, I suppose.
Yeah, so I suppose I just timed out. I was in the system and nothing was happening. It just goes quiet and that's what they do. And I suppose if I hadn't had a platform, that would have been the end of it. And I think for many people, that has been the case. And this is how they've treated conservatives. They never tell you no, but they won't progress you. Most people fall out of the system around the time of discernment, so before getting recommended to training. But I happen to fall out of the system post-training, and that happens to people too. But people got in touch. Bishops from all over the world got in touch to say, you know, we've been following your work. We think you're doing a good thing and we want to support you. And so certain bishops said, look, we want to speak to you about potentially ordaining you and seeing what we can do. And I got introduced to the GAFCON movement, which I think is a godsend, giving people a way of remaining Anglican, truly Anglican, but staying Orthodox. And for people like myself who feel the Church of England has left them behind and moved into apostasy, we can still stay rooted in our Anglican expression of the Christian faith. And so the GAFCON movement, I think, is amazing. It's doing great things on the African continent and in North America. And now in Australia too, they have set up a new diocese there, which is really, really good. It's very small over here in the United Kingdom in comparison to everywhere else, but at least it's here and it's alive and it gives people an option. So there are a couple of pathways in under GAFCON here. There's ACE and AMI, and there's the Free Church of England. I went the Free Church of England route, being more of a traditionalist and liturgist than evangelical. But even there, I appreciate both sides of that spectrum. I call myself an evangelical Catholic rather than one or the other. We are called to be Catholics, as in we are following the faith that was handed down to us from Christ through the apostles. So we are a traditional faith, but also we're called to be evangelical. We're called to disciple the nations. So we need to be doing both of those things. And likewise, if we look at what the Catholics are doing, they are fantastic at administering the sacraments and maintaining the importance of the sacraments. And the evangelicals are great at emphasizing the importance of the word of God and scriptural supremacy. Both of those need to come together too. You can't have the word without the sacrament. You can't have the sacrament without the word.
So what does the average day look like for you at the moment?
I'm just kind of getting into the swing of things. There isn't an average day yet. Today,
Do you hope there will be one day then? Because some people like every day being different.
Oh, good question. Yeah, I'd love to. So ideally, my average week would be, say, in the offices with my community. So say morning prayer and potentially evening prayer throughout the week. And then administering Holy Communion on a Sunday, probably having a Saturday off or something like that, and doing a show on GB News on a Sunday afternoon as well. That would be the ideal week. At the moment, it's a bit more sporadic, but Sundays are the main day, so I can't obviously celebrate the Eucharist yet because I'm a deacon, I'm not a priest. So we do matins every Sunday, unless I get someone else in, and twice a month at the moment, I'm trying to get a priest in to celebrate with us and preside for us. But if they're not there, I'm doing morning prayer in the Book of Common Prayer. And then in the afternoon on a Sunday, I do my show on GB News, which is launching this Sunday. But until then, I've been covering and using the slot for other people.
Hey, this is Sam. Really hope you're enjoying this conversation right here on the Profile podcast today. Could you do me a favor right now? It'll take you just 2 seconds to give us a rating and a review wherever you found this podcast. Just a couple of seconds to give us a rating is so, so helpful. It helps other people to discover the show as well. So if you could do that, we would so appreciate it. I mentioned at the beginning, you've had really quite a dramatic rise to prominence, and you'll have to give me the numbers, but I know you've got 200,000 Twitter followers right now. Am I right in thinking that, I don't know how long ago, it was far fewer than that, let's say?
Yeah. I think when I entered seminary, it was 30,000. So it's gone up quite rapidly.
And how does that affect you kind of on an emotional, spiritual level? Because again, I think for a lot of people listening to this, they can't really comprehend having a platform where you can just, oh, I've had a thought, let's write it down in 280 characters, then, oh, okay, potentially millions of people could be looking at it. Or similarly, a lot of people can't really quite comprehend going on TV and having a platform like that. Mm. Especially for you, because it did happen very quickly, almost overnight. Mm. How did you find that?
I suppose I didn't realise, to be honest, because I was living in seminary, and like I say, this was my interest, my hobby. So it was just day to day, I was praying, I was learning, I was eating, I was doing my media. It was just habit, day in, day out. And then suddenly people started to recognize me. I'm like, that's a bit weird. And people will say things to me like, well, you know, with your platform, et cetera, et cetera. I'm like, what do you mean with my platform? It just happened. It just happened to be there all of a sudden, I realized. But I don't take it for granted at all. I think, like I said, this platform is gifted to me and it could be gone in the click of a finger. And I suspect it will be one day, because the way that social media is quite lefty liberal in a lot of ways, and it doesn't like Christian values, doesn't like traditional values. So I suspect at some point I'll be banned So I just take every day as it comes, and I'm not under any impression that it will last forever. The same with the TV stuff. You know, so many of my good friends, Colin Brazier is a good example. I think he's a fantastic presenter, also a good Christian, and he's no longer there. And when you see things like that happen, you realize, okay, this is not forever. This is until it lasts. So you've got to make the most of it and spread the good news while you can.
Are you saying that you're almost like expecting some kind of Twitter storm that will end some of your media platform?
Not a Twitter storm. I just expect Twitter to block me at some moments.
But why? Why would Twitter block you?
Because they are, well, liberal progressive and woke. And
do you think Twitter wants to ban conservatives and chuck?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They've made a great effort of banning conservatives over the last couple of years. I mean, the sitting president of the United States of America got banned, for goodness sake. And people can argue about Trump either way, whatever. But the point is, if they can ban the most powerful man in the world, they can ban any conservative.
And in terms of Christians, are you concerned that Christians in the UK are being marginalised or even persecuted? Where do you stand on that debate? Because some people are very, I know some people are uncomfortable, particularly with the word persecuted, because they say, well, you know, we're not being killed for our faith like some Christians around the world are. But where do you stand on that debate?
Well, it's clearly the most persecuted faith in the world. But how that manifests in the UK is that we're ostracised and stigmatised, and it's, you know, it's making people embarrassed and ashamed. And that's sad to see, that people don't want to stand up for their faith anymore and don't want to affirm it loudly and proudly as they should. Because it's a joke. You know, people think you can make fun of Christianity where they wouldn't dare do it to any other religion, not because of the consequences, and there would be severe consequences for some, just because it's inclusive and diverse and it's a good thing to support other religions. But Christianity, because it's ours, it's easy to mock, and it's right to mock even. And it's that self-flagellation that we have going on in the United Kingdom at the moment. That anything that is ours is, of course, bad, because we're bad people. We've had a bad history. We're, everyone else is, you know, not that they're better than us, but it's exotic. It's foreign. It's actually quite a patronizing form of racism, I think, that anything that's not British is to be celebrated, but anything that's British is to be denigrated.
Is it not that I'm thinking of some comedians in particular here, they rightly or wrongly see Christianity as this kind of established, been around a long time, and in the same way that it's kind of open season on politicians, because they're in a position of power, we can mock them. Isn't Christianity seen in those terms? Well, you know, it's kind of been the state faith, it's been around a long time. There's real power within Christianity. You know, it's okay to mock them, whereas opposed to this minority over here have really had it hard. We won't be so quick to mock them. But it's because Christianity is seen as kind of powerful and institutional that it be mocked in the same way that politicians are. Is that not some of the mindset?
Yeah, I think they do think they're punching up, but they're not looking at the consequences, in that faith helps people, especially the Christian faith helps people, because it's the one true faith. And actually, if we look at the numbers, it's dipping, and people are more lost and lonely and isolated now than ever. And they're not seeing that it's the most persecuted religion around the world. They still think that they're punching up, even though they're not. And there is no power. There is no influence. We saw over lockdown the way that the church stepped back rather than stepping forward to help people. So I think it's a lack of awareness on their part.
I think as well, I was going to mention the new census results are due out quite soon, and everyone's basically expecting that to show that Christians are now in the minority, so under 50%, or maybe just around that figure. I mean, most people predicting that the Christianity effectively becomes a minority faith.
That's a good point, Sam, because Islam will become the majority faith in this country, of course, after atheism, which is a faith in itself. But will they start punching up towards Islam, do you think? That's a genuine question.
I've heard similar questions asked about if Christianity does become this minority religion, could there then be a pressure on, to use Channel 4 as an example, Channel 4, part of its remit is to talk about marginalised groups. Well, if Christianity is not in the majority anymore, will Channel 4 suddenly start doing lots of programming around Christian faith because it's now seen as a minority? So it'll be interesting to see how things get flipped if the census shows what people are expecting, or indeed don't get flipped, which I suppose is what you're getting at.
That's a good sidestep there. But yeah, the answer to the question is no, they won't start punching up to Islam because they wouldn't dare.
When that happens, and when we see, as we already have done, you know, church attendance falling, number of Christians falling, what do you think is the answer to that? I mean, we had this conversation recently, didn't we, Calvin? Because Christianity Magazine, we ran a big feature entitled How to Halt the Decline, and you were one of the contributors. And I don't know if you flicked through the pages of the magazine and saw, but we published a very wide range of views. And there's some very, very different ideas as to how we halt the decline. But I think what all Christians can agree with is, certainly looking at most of the denominations, there is real freefall happening here in the numbers. Fewer people identifying as Christian, fewer people going to church. What's your view on how we turn the tide?
I actually think it's quite simple. We just have to look at where the faith is a success and look at where it's a failure and match the differences. So where it's a success in South America, in Latin countries, on the African continent, it's because the faith is rooted in the Bible and rooted in tradition. And those two things are one of the same, really and truly. Where it's failing is where people no longer think the Bible is the most important part of the faith, as in they think there are elements they can disregard because we're more progressive now and we understand things that they didn't understand back in those bigoted days, or where they disregard tradition and they think actually what we need to be doing is becoming more relevant. And I hate that word because the church should never be relevant in that sense. Wherever we try to chase society, we will flop because we're always going to be 10 years, if not 20 years behind society. We will never catch up. It doesn't work like that. The church as an institution is too big. And all we do is look old fashioned and out of date and look like a fad. The exact things that put me off when I was younger are putting people off today. And if you look at places where they're having, where they're saying the Latin mass, young people are turning up in droves. And I can't, the thing I cannot stand the most is patronizing behavior. And as an ethnic minority, people often patronize me for that reason. But we also do the same for young people. And we say, oh, young people can't access the King James Bible, or young people can't because the language is too archaic, or young people don't want to see candles and smells and bells and all of this nonsense. It's like, how do you know that? Have you asked young people? And if so, have you asked them all? Because they're not all the same. They're a diverse bunch of people, just like the rest of us. So I think what we need to do is stop making those assumptions and look at the data. And the data shows that tradition and scripture are what people want, and they are what works. This is why the church has survived for 2,000 years.
I wonder as well if sometimes, and I can be guilty as charged on this one, sometimes even as Christians, we can be a bit too pessimistic. I mean, Jesus did say, I will build my church, and even the gates of hell cannot prevail against it. So even if we are seeing a bit of decline here, as you say, internationally, it's quite the opposite, isn't it? And I think sometimes it's good to remind ourselves of that there's an awful lot more going on in the world than just the UK.
Absolutely. And the church is growing around the world. That's a great thing to see. Christ's church will never fail. It will never fall. He won't let it. That doesn't mean the Church of England will never fall or fail, certain expressions of the church might fall away, but that might be a good thing because something else will grow in their wake.
We mentioned COVID right at the beginning, and I'd love to revisit that because it's something you've spoken a lot about and have some views on that. Again, you know, you're saying a common sense, but I suppose your argument is some of those common sense views weren't widely heard in parts of the mainstream media. I know in particular on vaccines, you have some views on that. If I could just put to you the general church position, I'm not just talking about the Church of England, but I'm talking about cross denominations here.
Yeah.
And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but my memory is really that we were struggling with this new virus called COVID, and however long in we developed a vaccine. And generally speaking, church leaders were quite happy to say to their congregations, we think you should take the vaccine. And they didn't see it as a political statement. They saw it as a kind of public health statement. And I think it was particularly encouraged amongst church leaders who were ethnic minorities, because we know the take up of the vaccine amongst ethnic minorities was lower. And so church leaders saw themselves as providing almost a kind of public service to encourage people to take the vaccine.
Yes, yes.
What's your view on that approach?
The church is not a public service in that way. It's not a public institution. It's not a government body. And people that think it is have lost their way.
But they saw it as a matter of health. They saw it as a matter of, in the same way that I suppose you wouldn't disagree with a church leader discouraging someone from smoking, for example, in the same way a church leader could encourage someone to take a life-saving.
It's not their place to discourage someone from smoking. That's not
really?
No. And it's the same. So masks is a good example of this.
What about drugs? I mean, what about illegal drugs? Because that's a health issue.
Well, then you can come into, that's more of a law issue than a legal issue than a health issue. But
it's not illegal to be an alcoholic, but if you're a church leader on the grounds of health, you would encourage someone away from that.
That's grounds of sin. That's excess. What I see this is an issue of faith, right? So if we are saying we truly believe in a living God, and we believe we are under his protection, and we pray to him, and we serve him, we should never, ever, ever close the doors to his house. If we say that church is his house on earth, the place where we go to be close to him together and to pray and worship him, why would we close that? Unless we don't believe in it, unless we don't believe it's strong enough or powerful enough or important enough. If we put something else above that, that is quite literally idolatry. And that's what public health has become. It's an issue of idolatry. Closing churches was demonic. Mosques is troubling because people are saying, essentially, praying and is not enough. Being faithful is not enough. You need something else too. If you come into God's house, you must be wearing a mask. And you also aren't allowed in cathedrals unless you have a vaccine and can show proof of that vaccine. Whether that vaccine prevents you spreading the virus or not doesn't matter. It's the mark that's important. It's the fact that you have conformed to what society is asking you to do that's important. It's like, no, I'm here to conform to God's will, not your will, not their will, just to God's. And that's been lost along the way somewhere. And the fact that the church itself, I mean, it's been covered a million times, but stopping people going to church is one thing, which should never have happened. Even in plagues, people should be able to go to church because they need it. They need that sustenance. But even if you do stop people going, to stop priests going to pray for their own congregations, that is why I say it's demonic. That's wicked. I can't think of any reason you could say to an ordained minister, you are allowed into your church for maintenance purposes, but while you're there, you're not allowed to pray for the cure of souls. It's like, what other reason could you have for that other than being influenced by the wrong side? That's the problem I have with a lot of these measures.
So, I mean, you've covered quite a few things there, but your issue specifically with the vaccines, was your issue with vaccines the kind of passport element where it was required to get into places, or did you have an issue with the kind of principle of having a vaccine in the first place?
So much of it. It's this idea that people who haven't taken the vaccine are somehow lepers. But even if they were, Jesus would have been with the lepers. He wouldn't have separated himself from them. Again, it's returning to scripture. It's remembering what we're about. But it's the freedom of choice, the bodily autonomy. So that's more of a political argument than faith-based. But I don't know why people are using the faith to moralize in favor of the vaccine when, if they're saying they're rooted in science, they're saying it's about public health. They're not taking on board the fact that we don't know the science. We just certainly don't know a lot of the science. We didn't know when these vaccines came out how efficacious they were. And we know now they're a lot less efficacious than we thought they were. We didn't know when they came out how much they would prevent the spread of infection. And we now know it does very little to prevent the spread of infection. But
we do know that, generally speaking, you know, all other things being equal, it's going to be better for you on a health level to have a vaccine.
No, we don't know that. I would not concede that point. Not at all. I would say, actually, the risk of adverse effect from the vaccine is higher in a young male than the risks of adverse effects from the COVID virus. So I wouldn't say across the board, generally speaking, it's better to have the vaccine than to not. I would say people need to weigh up their options for themselves. If they're vulnerable, if they're elderly, if they have comorbidities,
it's definitely not a blanket rule. So you don't actually accept the scientific consensus?
No, the scientific consensus is that if you are a young male, you are more at risk of an adverse effect from the vaccine than you are from the virus. That is the scientific consensus. But this is my problem, that science isn't static. These things have changed from the beginning to now, and we now understand that even at the beginning, we understood that vaccines, the way vaccines work, it's not something you give to everyone. It's you give them to the vulnerable and people that need them, first and foremost. And people, the best possible thing you can have against the virus is immunity. And the best form of immunity is natural immunity over artificial immunity. These are things that we knew in science and things that we somehow have kind of neglected or forgotten.
It's been very interesting to see the debate over what you mentioned in terms of churches closing has really, I think, moved on quite substantially since the time we're talking about. I think at the time we're talking about, there were, of course, plenty of people saying we shouldn't be closing churches. But it seems to me that as the months have passed and more people have reflected on it, there's been more criticism than there was at the time. I don't know if you would agree with that or you've noticed that. But certainly, you're right. Some churches, a lot of churches, did close their doors. But my memory of that time is, while you're right, some services were not running, every church that I'm aware of was out there in the community delivering food. You know, I remember the great story of one pastor who said, right, okay, I'm not running a church service for, you know, his own reasons. He decided not to. He became a pizza delivery driver as part-time work, and he did it so that he could still see people in his congregation. And so he could still, you know, bring food to people, basically. So there were, although you're right, services shut, I remember there being a lot of kind of social action that churches were at the forefront of as well.
I love that people did that. That's amazing. But I don't think it was the majority at all. I think the majority of churches went along with what they were told to do, which was to close. A lot of churches went online, which I don't think you can substitute a service for an online service. A lot of priests took a long time to go back after the regulations were rescinded too. A lot of people got comfortable just doing their online faffing around in their kitchen and whatever. So I personally think part of the calling to ordained ministry is a life of martyrdom. I think you should be willing to die before denying people access to the sacraments. That's you know, the Blessed Sacrament is the most fundamental right of any Christian, not right, but necessity. And I don't think many people were willing to die for that right, for that necessity. Most of them were quite happy to be living life of convenience and getting up later and just going on the webcam for a bit. Maybe that's my own bias, but from what I saw, very few people were fighting to stay open. Fortunately, a church that I went to said, you know, I'm saying mass at this time. If you happen to be here at this time, good for you. And I think people who bent the rules like that are good eggs, but there were very few and far between. And many people have suffered as a result.
Well, sadly, we are running out of time, which is such a shame because there's so much more I want to talk about. If I could just ask you about one thing that you tweeted recently, I really wanted to dig into. You said being labeled a conspiracy theorist is a badge of honor these days. Mm. Over the past couple of years, more often than not, the conspiracy theorists have been proven right. And I wanted to ask what particular examples you could think of, because I couldn't think of any myself, but where have been the issues where conspiracy theorists have been proven correct?
Oh, gosh. In terms of vaccine mandates, as we just mentioned, is a good one, because people said, you know, vaccine passports are going to become a thing. And everyone was like, no, don't be silly. Even after we'd entered the stage of lockdowns and stuff, people were still saying, no, the governments would never, ever say that you have to have a vaccine. And in many countries around the world, they had blanket vaccine mandates. Fortunately, in this country, we didn't. But we still did say to healthcare workers and certain professions that you have to take this medication if you want to continue with your livelihood. So that was one of them. What else do we have? I mean, it's a case of people who've had opinions that have been classed as controversial have months down the line become the norm. Like the one you mentioned with church closures, at the time, very few people speaking up about it. Now it's a very normal opinion to say, of course the churches should have stayed open. It's the idea that if you're ahead of the curve, you are kind of ostracized and demonized for having a wild opinion, but later down the line when it's more acceptable, people are okay with you about it. That's what it's about. And this whole conspiracy theorist thing is quite pathetic, because it's a way of shutting people down. So they're saying, your views are so out there that I don't even have to engage with them. And that's how people manage to live in their own echo chambers. And that's not a good thing. We need to engage with different views. We need to challenge different views, especially when they're coming from a place of authority.
I've asked this, you'll have to forgive the terms at this point, but I've asked people on the left this question before, and I'd love to ask the same question of you on the right. And the question goes something like this. I don't know how much you know about Billy Graham. Shortly after I became editor of Christianity, he passed away, and we did a huge issue on Billy Graham. And one of the things I learned about him was that early on in his preaching career, he was quite political, and actually on issues that I think a lot of Christians would agree with on the more, you know, conservative end of things. And while I don't think he ever changed his conservative views, he did learn certainly to be less party political. And the reason he did that was he didn't want anything to become a barrier to the gospel. So the way I'd put it in modern language would be to say, you know, a preacher should not be overtly and often clearly tweeting things that are right wing, because they might alienate someone who politically is left wing but actually needs to hear the gospel just as much, and vice versa. So again, I've asked this of people who are more liberal and said, look, are you concerned that talking a lot about climate change or whatever the left wing issue is might be off-putting to those on the right who need to hear the gospel? But the same question to you, is that ever a concern for you, that you think, I am very out, you know, not outspoken, but I'm very public with my views on GB News and elsewhere. Is it ever a concern that might put off someone from listening to me on the issues of the gospel because they've already switched off because they don't like my politics?
Yeah, of course it is. It's a concern that I see across the board from my side and from the other side. When I see a Bishop of St. David's saying, never trust a Tory, I think, okay, that's problematic, because you're saying you cannot trust half of your flock or more than half of your flock. That is very concerning. So I'm always cautious of that myself. But at the same time, I also think that many clergy are very good people, but all of the episcopacy are lefty liberals. Therefore, there's a massive amount of the flock that are feeling left behind and neglected. So if I'm there offering a different perspective to them, that actually adds a bit of balance. So I don't worry about it as much, but I still do keep it in my head.
Yeah, that's interesting. Almost like you're balancing it out, but it's still a concern, I suppose. Go back to your comment earlier that you see this as it's bivocational, isn't it? And your media work isn't any more or less important to God as your work as a priest.
Yeah, when I talk about political issues, I'm never trying to convert people either. So I'm not here to say people on the left are wrong or bad or need to become people on the right. All I'm saying is, if you're on the right and you believe in traditional, you know, family structure is a good thing, if you believe that abortion is a bad thing, etc., these are good views to have. These are okay views to have. And I'm here to encourage people that already have these views that it's okay, rather than demonizing people that don't have these views. That's the difference.
So tell me, what does the future hold for you? You're just on the cusp of launching the show on GB News. What are your hopes and your aspirations for the coming months and years?
Genuinely have none. No aspirations, no ambitions. I just try to walk through the doors that God opens to me. And this far, it's been a surprise. So God knows where I'll be in another 5-10 years' time.
God knows indeed. That's a lovely place to leave it. Calvin, thank you so much for spending a bit of time with us here at Premier. I've really enjoyed it.
My pleasure. Thank you. God bless.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Profile podcast, brought to you by Premier Christianity, the UK's leading Christian magazine. We are bringing you fantastic interviews, the latest news and analysis on a daily basis at premierchristianity.com. And while you're there, you can also bag yourself a subscription to the print magazine. If you're in the UK, you can get the next 6 issues delivered direct to your door for just £9.99. And if you're listening to this from elsewhere in the world, you can pick up a digital subscription from just $1 a month. PremierChristianity.com. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.